Okay, I think we're ready to begin. I guess the first thing I'd like to bring to your attention is just the thought. What are you going to do with your life today? Why do you live? I think that we need to think about things like that from time to time. What are you going to do today? Of what value is your life? Why do we exist? I think that this chapter that we're reading here this morning has a lot to do with thoughts like that. We certainly do not exist just to get up every day and think about, what are we going to do today to enjoy ourselves? Where are we going to go? What are we going to do? It's so easy to go through life and go through life somewhat mindless of why we even exist. And so, one thing that we're already doing today that's tremendously important is being right here in this place. And the reason is because the Lord is here, and He has designed this place to meet with us, to teach us how we ought to think, how we ought to live, what we ought to be doing. And if we're not in touch with the Lord, who is able to make us aware of these things, then we're going to be just like everybody else in the world. We're just going to be living. That's about it. Thinking about the mundane things that we might do the rest of the day, or places we might go, or where we're going to go eat, things of that sort. But as the Lord looks down from heaven upon this earthly scene, and when we contemplate His eternal purpose and the outworking of that purpose every day, which includes today, which also includes you. We're gonna miss the value of our life today if we're not careful. The vested interest that God has in you and me is beyond imagination. And the exclusive mission that we have, the exclusive purpose that we have, is huge. And the reason is because the Lord tells us that we are the light of the world. We're the light of the world. And so the question is, what is the light of the world? Namely, you and I, as it's revealed in Scripture, what are we supposed to be doing? From His perspective, what are we supposed to be doing? Well, the message is we are to be His witnesses. We're to be a testimony of what God thinks, and we're to be a testimony to the world concerning the person of Jesus Christ. And all of this is so important, and what I'm saying is right here on the surface in this chapter. For instance, in verse 11, it says, "I am Alpha and Omega, the first and the last. What thou seest, write in a book and send it unto the seven churches." Write it in a book. and send it unto the seven churches. I want them to think about this. Well, those seven churches are what you might say a soil sample of all the true churches in the world. And the message to these seven churches is the message that we need to be thinking about. And so, what is it that's written in the book? What is it that we're supposed to think about today that's going to enable us to carry out the purpose of God as he looks down upon this world with all his invested interest in this little planet? I often think about it. I think I spoke to you the other week about having taken the video home, The Privileged Planet, and looking at it again. I'm fascinated with that video because it puts a lot of things in perspective. One of the things that impresses me about it is what a speck planet Earth is when you consider the eternal creation. And in this video, it was as though you were on board a rocket and you were flying through the galaxies, and all of a sudden the narrator turns your attention back in the direction you just left, and it starts out, you can see the sun and the moon and the earth, and very shortly, traveling at a tremendous rate of speed, it just begins to blend in with a lot of other dots. And then finally, you look back toward planet Earth, and you don't know where it is. It's lost. And when you keep on going, how important is this place? And when we think of ourselves walking around on this planet, and we begin to see how small we really are as we consider the scope of things, what is your life? What are we doing with it? And why would God attach so much importance to this place, this small thing called Earth, and our little puny existences? We walk around as though we're something. When we walk across the parking lot out here and we look down from time to time, and we'll see a colony of ants. And sometimes, I'm sure you've experienced this, you haven't noticed them until you've already stepped on their city and destroyed it and killed maybe 50 or more of them. And maybe we're on our way to the mailbox and we say, oh, well, okay, that's interesting, ant colony. And we look back toward the mailbox and our thoughts are immediately turned back toward getting the mail, and we quickly forget that we just killed 50 ants. And who cares? And how are we different when you consider how small we really are? But our importance is only as it relates to the mind of God. Because, folks, we're as good as dead. We're dying. We're going to die. And you can try to attach value to your life and what you do, but you're not going to go very far until you come to this book. And then all of a sudden, the value of your life is beyond imagination. And so when we think about it this way, when we think about it from the perspective of God, we might equip ourselves to maybe think a little bit more carefully about what we're going to do today with this life. Well, we've started out pretty good because we're here where the Lord told us to not forsake the assembling of ourselves together. He said, this is where I want you to be. Don't forsake the assembling of yourselves together, because I'm going to be there. And I'm going to give you thoughts that are going to make your life of great value. And so, with those thoughts, let's consider. Last week I asked the ones in attendance to spend some time thinking about what we're studying here in this first chapter. I did have one to write me a paper and bring it to me. I was suggesting that we study for ourselves and just prayerfully ask the Lord to show us what these things mean, because we're not supposed to just read Revelation chapter 1. We're supposed to study it. That's what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to study it. It's very easy to come to Sunday school and just sit back and you know, hear whatever I have to say and go out of here without struggling to want to take these thoughts with you and remember them and see the value of them as tools that God is providing for you to use in your life. I'm living my life. I can't live anybody else's life. I have my own responsibility to God. You have your responsibility to God, and it's equal to anyone else's. I'll never forget Brother Kent saying one time, you expect me to study the Bible because I'm the preacher. I'm the Bible teacher. But what does the verse mean that says, study to show thyself approved unto God? Who's he talking about, the preacher? No. He's talking about all of us. We all have this responsibility. And so one day, you're going to stand before the Lord to give an account of what you understood concerning this book that he has bothered to inspire and preserve for us to study. And being the architect that he is, he has designed the church. And he says, this is where I want you to meet, and I don't want you to forsake the assembling of yourselves together, because I'm going to teach you there as often as you assemble, so that you will be able to go out and be the kind of light unto the world that I want you to be. This is very important. And so I did have one. I'm sure that all of you have thought about these things. I trust that you have. But I did have one who wrote me up a very insightful paper here on the meaning of some of these things. We've been trying to understand Alpha and Omega. What does that mean? I mean, really, when we look into it, is this all we're going to be able to say about it? Well, it just says in the 8th verse, I am Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the ending. Well, what is that going to mean to somebody if we're sitting down as the light of the world trying to illumine their understanding to get a handle on this in a way that's going to make a difference in their thinking? Well, I'm going to read just one statement out of this paper that was given to me. I thought it was just very in Zephel. He says, I am Alpha and Omega is all that was, all that is, and all that will be. It is more than any human mind is capable of fully understanding. But only a tiny spot for our Lord Jesus Christ. Now, this is very meaningful. Now, another thing that comes to my mind as I think about these thoughts, because the statements, when you first read them, they seem to be somewhat deep. I mean, there's not a meaning there that's right there on the surface, so we might say that it's a bit philosophical. It's kind of like reading a philosophy book. So it's somewhat philosophical. And a lot of times when it comes to deeper thoughts, our inclination is to just sort of glaze over the surface and not try to, you know, penetrate to really grasp what's being said here. That is a huge mistake. Now, let me say this about this chapter. Yes, it is a bit philosophical, and the kind of statements that are made here strain the human imagination to enter into the meaning of it. It really does. And what I'm reminded of when I read this is I'm reminded of some 2,500 years ago, a little less, when the philosophers in the Grecian Empire were trying to grasp these same thoughts, these exact thoughts right here. And their means for doing it was not through the means of the book that God has written, but by the means of human reason. And so these thinkers, these humanist thinkers, got together, various ones of them, and they wrote lengthy books in an attempt to answer these things right here. Same things. Alpha and Omega. The beginning and the ending. The first and the last. Well, many years ago when I was first thinking about these things in a basically lost condition, just looking at the world the same way the Greeks did, trying to grasp these things just with my own human understanding. I began to realize I wasn't getting anywhere. I just wasn't getting anywhere. And the more I read the philosophers, the more I realized that they weren't getting anywhere either. And again, I say to you, one of the most profound statements that you'll read in the New Testament is a statement of Pilate, who had read the same philosophers that students are reading right now in the university systems here in North Carolina, when he said, "What is truth?" He had read them. He still didn't have an answer to the big questions. Well, in philosophy, there is a term called metaphysics. Now, before you sit there and get to thinking, well, here goes Dwight again off on his little philosophical tangents, and this isn't interesting, and this doesn't really address the, you know, practical Christian living. I didn't write this book. And to some people, to read thoughts like this, it may not be that interesting because it doesn't touch the immediate problems that you're dealing with every day. But maybe what the Lord is trying to tell us is the little things that you're preoccupied with are not that important. Okay, he has written a book. And this is what he is saying. This is what God is saying to the churches. And you know what he's saying? He's actually right here in the first chapter of Revelation giving us the answer to the question of Pilate. What is truth? And he's giving it to the churches. He's telling John, write it in a book, send it to the churches, because their mission is to do what the philosophers could not. And you are going to be the light of the world. And you're going to answer the questions that no man can answer unless he sits at my feet. And here's me give the answer. And that's what Revelation chapter 1 is all about. So, in philosophy, one of the big old words that you run into is the word metaphysics. Metaphysics. And I can remember going all through college using that term from time to time, never really getting a good handle on it. I remember quite a number of years ago, after Brother Kent and I met Dr. R.J. Rushdoony, I did have an opportunity to talk with him from time to time. And from time to time, I would call him up, and I would talk to him on the phone. And I asked him at one point if he would mind if I recorded what he said. And I think that I still have a tape in my desk back there where I recorded a conversation with him where I asked him about a couple of philosophical terms that I had never really had explained to me when I was in college in a way that I could get a handle on it and really know what those terms meant. And one of them was metaphysics, and I asked him, what does this mean? He said, the word that will help you understand metaphysics is the word origins. Origins. He says, this is what it embraces. It embraces the question of origins. Well, can you think of a thought that would exercise the human mind more than that thought? I'm telling you that every human that is born into the world, at some point in their development, they've maybe never heard of the word philosophy before. It doesn't matter. Everybody is a philosopher. Everybody is in pursuit of answers to many, many questions. We're born with questions. And there's no child coming along that doesn't grow up in a home asking parents, ponder some questions. Like, where did I come from? That's metaphysics. Little children contemplate origins. This is huge. And there's something about that question, as little children think about it, that requires an answer. And if you don't find the answer in a meaningful way, then you're going to go through life kind of lost because you don't have that reference point. You've got to have a reference point for everything to come together. And the philosophers desperately wanted it. Folks, listen to me. When I think about the philosophers, and I think about them sitting out there trying to figure out the answers to the big questions of life, to some extent, I feel a kind of compassion toward them, in that I could see a kind of despair. Yet mixed with it was a pride, in that they wanted to answer it for themselves. And they didn't have the humility to ever acknowledge, I don't have any answers. Never met anybody that has. Somebody has got to come and tell us. Somebody from out there has got to come and tell us. Because we can't go there and get it. And the whole significance of the nativity in Jesus Christ coming into this world is because that was the only remedy for the human intellect. He had to come. He had to come. Folks, you need to be able to take these kinds of thoughts and carry them out here in the world and explain them to people, because I'm telling you, thousands upon thousands of children are going to college every year in this state and in this nation and in the world. And they're not going to hear these kinds of things. Not there. Because this information is not available in the university. It is available only in the churches. That's it. We are the light of the world. We are the only ones that have the answers to the questions. The only ones. And so I go back to the original question, what are you going to do with your life? What are you supposed to be doing? We're supposed to be witnesses. And we're supposed to be able to explain to this world out here the basic questions of human existence. Where do we come from and how do we know? I asked Dr. Rush Dooney, the second term I wanted an explanation for was epistemology. And he said, okay, when you see that word, you need to ask this question, how do we know? How do we know? How do we know that we know? In other words, he said, we're searching for authority. We're searching for authority. How do we know that we know with authority? How do we know? That's critically important. Now, one of the reasons I delight in using in conversation with people, as often as I can insert it, things like, I'm going to tell you something that cannot be refuted. Why would a person say something that way? Well, the reason is because I believe that I can tell somebody things that cannot be refuted. I really believe that. Well, is that because I'm a prideful person? No. It's because God did things like telling John, write it in a book. Write it in a book. And send it unto the seven churches. The unrefutable answer is not original with me. It's right here. And as long as I am teaching this, cannot be refuted. It cannot be done. And there are so many areas of life where we can be absolutely right about it. And we're the only ones on the face of the earth that are qualified to address these questions. No one else is. Kids are going off to the university thinking that they're going to come out with an education. Well, it's like Brother Kent said in his book, Separation of Church and Freedom. A person that, in the course of their education, never receives the right answers to the big questions cannot truly be said to be educated. And so Christian education is the acquisition of true knowledge and true wisdom. We're the ones that have the truth. We're the ones that have the true science. It's not the science falsely so called. We have the true science. And so when we sit down and talk with people about these things, we need to be able to address it this way and explain to them in the most humble way how we came by this information. It's because it's written in the book that God has given us. He has come down. He came down with a message. He inspired it to the prophets. And he came down personally. And so we see some thoughts here that are huge, to say the least. And again, these reach the heights of all philosophical pursuits. I am Alpha and Omega. The beginning and the ending, the first and the last. He says, I'm he that liveth and was dead. Behold, I'm alive forevermore. These are amazing things. Now, another thing that is important to keep in mind as we go through these thoughts is the warning of the Apostle Paul about the preaching of another Jesus, another spirit, another gospel. Now, the thing that helps us escape making that mistake is paying close attention to these words. Look at verse 8. I am Alpha and Omega. No person is here identifying God. No person outside of God is here identifying God. So who is identifying? How do we come to this definition here? Well, God is identifying himself. That's critically important. It's critically important. The reason there are warnings in this Bible from cover to cover, and we need to be able to say these kinds of things to people, to have them think about it. The reason all throughout the scriptures that it teaches us that the words of the Lord are pure words, the silver tried in the furnace of earth, purified seven times. Thou shalt keep them, O Lord, from this generation forever. And then he says, don't add to it and do not take away from it. Do not add to it and do not take away from it. It is written in stone, symbolically. The Ten Commandments were written in stone. This was God's symbolism for the whole Word of God. It's written in stone. You don't change something that's written in stone. If it's written in stone, it's done. You don't change it. God himself said concerning his own person, I am the Lord, I change not. I do not change. And so Peter goes on to explain further, there's no private interpretation. Do not privately interpret. When you privately interpret, then you end up with another Jesus, another spirit, another gospel. Because what you're doing when you privately interpret is you're projecting onto God your view of him. the message of this book is that that's the philosopher all over again. That's the Greek philosopher trying to rise to the level of being able to explain God and identify God. Can't do that. So the predicament that we're in, as Pilate acknowledged, what is truth? Is that we can't know. We cannot know God unless he comes and reveals himself. That's what Revelation chapter 1 is all about. Folks, listen. We've got to see this. We've got to see the connection of this chapter with history. And we need to be mightily impressed with history and the movements of history and the things that we've learned from those different periods in history. And I believe with all my soul that the Grecian Empire and the time of those great Greek thinkers, the reason the Lord has allowed those books to continue so that they're still being taught in the university system, just like they were taught in the Roman schools that Pilate attended, is so that we can look at all of this evidence and see the proof of what God is saying here in this book. You cannot, as Paul said, ascend into the heavens and bring Christ down. You cannot descend into the deep and bring up Christ from the dead. He has to do it all. He has to come down. He has to be resurrected and come back and tell us. We have no power in either direction. Whether it's ascending up or descending down. This chapter answers all of those seeming dilemmas that the philosophers had. Because here Christ has come and he is revealing himself as the metaphysic, as the first cause, as the first principle. And he identifies himself in this same chapter, if you see the connection with what Paul wrote the Romans, that no man can descend into the depths, that is, to bring up Christ from the grave. And he addresses that right here. Verse 18. I am he that liveth and was dead, and behold, I am alive forevermore. Amen. So here we have it. God has given us the big picture of truth. And he's giving this truth to the churches. And we're the ones and the only ones that have the answer to the questions. We're the only ones. Okay, so let's go back to verse 8 and let's dwell on this a little bit more, where he says, I am Alpha and Omega. The thought that comes to my mind, and there are numbers of angles of just addressing this. This is God's way of saying to us that he's the author of all knowledge and wisdom, because Alpha and Omega is the beginning and last letters of the Greek alphabet, and it's God's way of saying that I'm the sum of all knowledge and wisdom. I'm the sum of it. There is no source outside of me for knowing anything. I'm the only source. And that's absolutely the truth. the Greek philosophers are a proof of this. Man cannot know. At his best state, he cannot know. The philosophers were intellectuals at man's best state of intellectualism. And they utterly failed. And the reason is because they would not go to the source and hear him. God has to tell you for you to know. And so I would say that Alpha and Omega means that he is the sum of all knowledge and wisdom and the exclusive source of it. You can't go to the university in the hopes of finding answers. If you're going to invest your hope in the library, it's not going to be in there. There are hundreds of thousands of volumes of books in libraries in most universities around about the nation and the world. And you can sit in there and you can read every one of them. And you won't know any more than you knew when you walked in the door when you read the last volume, if it was humanly possible. I mean, if it was possible, such a thought. Unless somewhere they found this book, the Bible. This is the only source. And guess what? We're gathered here at Calvary Memorial Church, and we don't have a library back here. And I'm not grabbing books out of a, you know, off of the shelf of some huge library back here to come in here and talk about things. I've got just one book, the Bible. That's all we need. That's what this means. There isn't one source. We got it. So what are we going to do with our life? What value do we place on this book, and how much energy are we expending in the days of our life studying so that we might be able to take what we learn from it and carry it out here as the Lord's witnesses? That's what this is all about. So, if you come here today just to hear the message, as an end in itself, you're wasting your time. I'm wasting my time. If I go back there into the office and I just study for myself to increase my knowledge and then I don't do anything with it, it would be no different than buying a new car, filling it full of gas, and then just letting it sit in the yard. Never put the key in it, never go anywhere on it or in it. It'd be a waste, a wasteful investment. And so the Lord doesn't want us to waste our investment. He wants us to take this information and carry it out here. And we need to be getting up every day, including today, and praying and saying, Lord, please send people my way. I'm not intelligent enough to know how to deal with people out here. People are so messed up. And I'll probably try to talk to somebody that doesn't want to be talked to. And I've gone through those kinds of disappointments before. But I tell you what works best for me is to get up in the morning and pray a simple prayer and say, Lord, I'm not intelligent enough to serve you. I don't know how to serve you. But I tell you this, I'm willing to serve you. And if you will bring people my direction and set it up so that I can talk to them, if you'll give me the understanding as I'm speaking with them, I will speak with them because I want to. I desire to tell people about you. And I tell you what, you'll be surprised at what will happen. And you go to bed at night, and it might not even dawn on you what you've been doing in the course of the day. But in hindsight, all of a sudden you'll say, you know, this morning I prayed and I asked the Lord to bring people my way. And I wasn't even aware of it when it happened, but he did. He did. And you'll realize that after it's over, when you're lying in your bed at night, you won't even realize that the Lord was using you to witness to somebody. And you were taking the tools of this understanding right here and actually using them in the conversation, and you weren't even conscious of it. I think some of the most effective witnessing that is ever done is done that way. If you are consciously out here witnessing to people, if you're not careful, you'll get all caught up in yourself and caught up in all the things that you know that are so wonderful, and you're trying to, you end up in almost a, well, sort of like a debate sort of thing. Okay, you've got your way of thinking, I've got my way of thinking, and I'm going to win in this conversation by presenting better arguments. And you can reduce witnessing to something that's rather mechanical and rather meaningless, where the spirit of caring isn't really there. And you can just go through the motions because this is what Christians are supposed to do. And the Spirit of the Lord not be involved in it. I think that it's better to be so consumed by this book that when we go out here and we're witnessing to people, we're not even really aware that we're doing it. And it just flows out. But the primary thing is a desire to do it. A desire. Today, do you have a desire to tell people about this message? Do you have that desire? Alpha and Omega is just another expression of John 1:1. In the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. It's just another way of expressing the same thought. In the beginning was the Word. There is no truth outside that Word. It's a summary statement. In the beginning was the Word. There were no words outside this Word. Same thing. So when we read the Bible, we need to be able to see the connection between various other expressions in the Bible to see how the Lord is using language to just give us another facet, another way of expressing some of the same basic thoughts and ideas. Another expression is, I am the truth. I am the way and the truth. I am the truth. There is no other truth. He's the only truth there is. He is the Alpha and the Omega. There's nothing outside of Him. He's all that there is in the way of truth. Alpha and Omega is, He has made unto us wisdom. Paul wrote to Corinthians, and he said that. He has made unto us wisdom. And this is the Alpha and the Omega. In Colossians chapter 2 and verse 3, you have other words that express exactly the same thing that is being said here in Revelation 1, I am Alpha and Omega, where Paul writes to Colossians in Colossians 2 and verse 3 and says, in Him are hid all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. And so the Lord has equipped us with different ways of expressing the same thing to further impress the thought. And then we come down to the next little phrase here, the beginning and the ending. The beginning and the ending. What does this mean? Well, one of the things that comes to my mind is what the Apostle John said in 1 John chapter 2. Let me just read this. He says, I write unto you little children because your sins are forgiven you for his name's sake. I write unto you fathers because ye have known him that is from the beginning. I write unto you young men because ye have overcome the wicked one. I write unto you little children because ye have known the Father. I have written unto you fathers because ye have known him that is from the beginning. And so the Lord is talking about children and young men and fathers. And one of the characteristics of a father is he has known him from the beginning. So what is the Lord teaching us here by using language like that? Well, you know, and just everyday experience, if you can sit down with a person that has some years on them, you know, people that are 80 years old, 90 years old, where their mental faculties are very much in place and so forth, they can tell you a lot of stuff. And the reason is because their experience spans such a large period of time, they can present to you a big picture. A big picture. And that's important. And so the Lord is referring to fathers in the churches as being those that have spent quite some time maybe in this book to the point that they're beginning to see the big picture of things. And you're beginning to see origins. You're beginning to understand origins. But here the Lord says that he is the beginning. This is just another way of saying, I am the Father. I am the big picture. The beginning and the ending. The big picture. Come and sit at my feet. The Ancient of Days. And I will unfold to you the big picture from the beginning to the end. The eternal purpose of God. What life is really all about from beginning to end. That's a father. Now, when you understand these things, then it satisfies the soul. I can remember a time when I was looking, I was reaching out, I was trying to find. I'm not doing that anymore. I haven't done that in a long time. And the reason is because I have found him. He has found me. I'm not looking anymore. I haven't looked for many, many years for truth because I found it. And when you find it, you are satisfied. And I've been totally satisfied. You know, I have never feared sitting down and talking with anybody. I don't care what their education is. I don't care what kind of degrees they've got. Doesn't matter. And the reason is because when you come to understand things like Revelation chapter 1, you know that no one is going to come along with a form of understanding, a form of thinking that you've never thought of before, that somehow or other is going to undo your resolve. It ain't going to happen. I fear no man when it comes to truth. no man. All of us should be that way. And I think we are. I think you know exactly what I'm talking about. What success would somebody come with you to try to lure you away from what you believe to be true that you have learned in this place? What's the likelihood of that happening? I don't think it's possible. Because you're satisfied. God has shown you the truth. You have found him. And you're totally satisfied. Well, our time is gone. We've got to stop. So let's stop right here. And David, would you dismiss us in prayer, brother?